let me in. Shiba, shiba. I want to be closer to you. Shiba, shiba. Open up your soul. Shiba, shiba. Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your mind.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or understand something. It's the first Monday of the month, and you know what that means. That's right, folks. Scintillating Science Monday. And I have a guest who's been here before. You've all heard him. You've all loved him. I'd like to welcome the shapely and talented Tucker, how are you?
Oh, Marilyn, I am feeling good. I'm not sure I qualify for your shapely comment, but I'll try.
So, Tucker, tell us a little bit about your science background.
Yes, I loved science as a youngster. Mm-hmm. I think maybe it was Mr. Spock in the old Star Trek original series that pushed me over the edge, that made me want to make science a part of my adult, soon-to-be adult life. So I studied science at high school, good old San Mateo High School.
Okay.
Go Bearcats. And then went to UC Berkeley to study physics. And indeed got a physics degree, then went to UC Santa Cruz, go Slugs, to get a master's degree in physics. So that was probably the end of my formal understanding or education in science. But not long, I always wanted to be a high school science teacher, in particular a physics teacher. And indeed, I did that for 33 years.
Wow.
But in the process, toward the end of those 33 years, I got inspired by a famous astronomer and science popularizer named Carl Sagan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Sagan wrote a book called The Demon Haunted World, subtitled Science as a Candle in the Dark. And the book so enchanted me that I took a sentence from that book to found WonderFest. And the sentence went like this. Sagan said, "I hold that the popularization of science is successful if at first it does no more than spark the sense of wonder."
Oh.
And so WonderFest was born in 1997. And ever since then, it's been trying to bring science and scientists to the general public.
Okay. That sparked like a million questions, and I have a memory like a sieve, so I can't remember all of them. So I'm going to just try. And so you taught physics in high school for 33 years?
That's right, yes. And so, I got to say, I loved it.
I have to say, I don't think I even heard of physics in high school. That's how poor my high school science was. So was it an advanced thing, or how did that work?
Well, all right, my own experience as a high school student back in the early Pleistocene era,
uh-huh,
was that indeed not many students took physics. But ever since then, I'd say, or at least since the 1970s, maybe 1980s, more and more students have had the chance to take it, and I want to attribute that to the work of a physics teacher who wrote a book called Conceptual Physics. This is one of my science teaching heroes. His name is Paul Hewitt,
mm-hmm,
and Hewitt's Conceptual Physics. Hewitt started at City College of San Francisco, City College. And he wrote this book, and it's now in its 13th or 14th edition. And as its title implies, conceptual physics,
mm-hmm,
it doesn't put math at the center of physics. Math is sure important later on,
mm-hmm,
but when you're first trying to grasp the enormously interesting, even entertaining ideas of physics, it helps not right away to introduce too much math. So conceptual physics does that. And that's how I think I succeeded as a physics teacher for those 33 years.
Okay, so I'm a person who's never taken physics. So let's say I'm a student in your class, and you have a fresh high off of reading conceptual physics. Okay. What would you teach me to begin with to spark that desire or that wonder?
Oh, I love this. Okay, I think the first truly surprising for people around the world, the first truly surprising discovery mm-hmm. was the discovery of the relativity of speed. And I can make that more sensible.
Yes.
You know, you might think because I used the word relativity that I'm talking about Einstein. Mm-hmm. But no, I'm talking about Galileo. So this is hundreds of years ago.
Okay.
As far as we know, Galileo was the first person on Earth to figure out that constant uniform motion in a straight line is something we can't detect. That is, it has no absolute meaning. And the way to bring that statement to life is through, and this is fun, I think, is a question.
Uh-huh.
And I hope you and your listeners will forgive me because I think I've posed this question before, but it's so darn good and it's so darn eye-opening regarding the strangeness of the world, of the universe, that I've got to ask it again. Here comes the question.
Okay.
How fast are you moving right now?
Okay. So I know we're moving at the speed of the Earth, and I know that I'm sitting down. I don't know how fast the Earth moves. So, but I'm just going to say let X equal the speed of the Earth plus zero.
Wow.
Okay, that close?
Here, this is cool because, you know, I think we look back at history and we say, how could people not have known this? But, you know, I think people knew that the world was round
mm-hmm.
for a long time,
mm-hmm.
thousands of years, but that the Earth moved was something that was much harder to demonstrate, you know, because as you just said, you're sitting there on the Earth and the Earth's turning. We mm-hmm. all hear about that. No, nobody believes anymore that the sun rises literally, right? It's that the
right.
Earth turns, and so to us on the Earth, the sun seems to rise. But as you also might note, that the Earth not only turns, but it orbits, we're told, it orbits the sun. So there's this daily motion of rotation, and there's the annual motion of revolution. We revolve around the sun. And yet, both of those motions, if they happen at all, and I say they do, they're subtle, right? We don't feel them.
Right.
When you're in a car going at high speed, you seem to feel the motion.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with the Earth, I don't feel it at all. And I think the hard part, and only Galileo was the first to realize, that even the motion we experience or seem to feel in a car, he would have said in a fast-moving ship,
mm-hmm.
is something that we can only explain relative to something else. So when you and I say we're moving relative to the center of the Earth,
mm-hmm.
we just drop to the center of the Earth, and we both say, okay, we're both moving. And then we say, all right, but wait a minute, the center of the Earth around which we're spinning is also moving around the sun. And the sun is presumably moving around something else, maybe the center of the Milky Way galaxy.
Okay.
And so on. But the catch is that even if you try to say, well, wait a minute, all right, so we can then measure our speed relative to space, kind of like going back to Star Trek and my fondness for Mr. Spock,
mm-hmm.
if Captain Kirk asked Lieutenant Sulu, how fast are we going? Sulu would have said something like, oh, warp 5, Captain. And never did Sulu or Kirk bother to say, relative to what?
Mm.
It's tempting to say, well, we're moving at that speed through space, as if space were a thing you could move relative to. But it turns out, and this is Galileo's amazing discovery, that space is not a thing. Space is nothing. Space is no thing. You don't move through space. You may go from point A to point B, from Earth to Mars, but space is not a thing through which you can measure your speed, as you can, say, let's say, in a boat moving over the ocean. You can measure your speed relative to the water. Or a plane in the air. You can measure your speed relative to the air. But in space, there's no way to measure your speed except relative to specific objects like the sun or the earth or the center of the Milky Way.
Okay, so this is going to be a dumb question. I'm prefacing with that. So I always used to wonder, like, so when you're in an airplane and you're moving really, really fast, or actually even on a train, and say a fly gets caught in it, I could never understand why the fly didn't smash into the front of the plane. But it sounds like you're saying we're all moving so incredibly quickly that what little stuff we are doing doesn't make a difference?
I like to think that I'm on an airplane. I haven't flown a lot, but I'm on a flight where the pilot announces that we're going at, say, 500 miles per hour.
Yeah.
All right. Now, that usually the pilot won't say it, but that's usually relative to the ground beneath us.
Okay.
All right, so 500 miles per hour. And then suppose the flight attendant, in a hurry to distribute the snacks, tosses one of those little containers of peanuts in my direction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of wondering, why don't the peanuts plow into me at 500 miles per hour? Yeah, it's that the peanuts and the flight attendant and I are all just chugging along with the pilot in the airplane, right? To us, we have a so-called reference frame, and we're oblivious to its motion relative to the Earth. And Galileo's amazing insight was that that's true of all motion, that as long as you don't accelerate, that is, go faster or even go slower or turn, that's a form of acceleration. Only when you accelerate can you actually feel your motion. If it's an acceleration in your car, you feel thrown back against the seat.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a braking, a slowing down, a deceleration, you feel thrown forward into the dashboard, or we hope into the seatbelt. Or if the car turns, you feel thrown to the car door or into your seat-sharing partner on your right.
Mm-hmm.
So only accelerations are, in a sense, absolute. Constant speed is entirely relative. It has no absolute meaning. You got to say, if you're going at, like right now, relative to the center of the Earth, you and I in San Francisco or nearby are moving at about 800 miles per hour.
Wow.
Relative to the center of the Earth.
So let me see if I understand this. So what you're saying is it's really sort of the act of acceleration, and then once you get a steady speed, you quickly become acclimated to that speed. And when you slow down, you feel it, and then you quickly become acclimated to that speed, correct?
That's exactly it, yes. Well, I'll add just one more thing to drive you nuts, and that is the idea of initial acceleration from zero speed. Yes, that's right, and then we get up to some high speed, and as long as we stop accelerating, we won't feel that motion anymore.
Okay.
But In a grand, universal, or cosmic sense, the very notion of being at rest is nonsensical. That is, it's meaningless. We don't know what it means to be at rest. And that's so strange. Does that comment make sense to you?
Yes, it does, because we're constantly moving, so...
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
And the only time it really makes sense to say... that I'm moving, and that's the strangeness of the question I first posed, is how fast are you moving right now? This, the only thing is, you got to say, the best answer is relative to what? And my students love that, right? When a teacher dares to ask a question to the crowd, of the audience, of the students, it's cool when the student's best answer, the best possible answer, is a kind of snarky responding question.
Mm.
Relative to what? Big shot teacher.
Okay. So is that the first thing you would have taught the students?
I think so. You know, aside from, let's say, laying down the law about, you know, you got to do your homework, and we will have tests every now and then.
Sure, but...
The painful part of teaching. Yeah, I think it is so cool when you can tell somebody something that everybody is surprised to learn. Because we all go through this Galileo phase of our lives where we just we think we're really moving, really with capital R, really moving when we're in a car. And the thing is, if the cops pull you over someday for speeding, and the cop asks you, "Hey, buddy, do you know how fast you're going?" You can say, "Relative to what, officer?" It's not a good response, but it is a physically effective and honest response.
All right. Okay, so here's a fact that has been spinning in my head ever since I saw it in one of those planetarium movies at the Academy of Science, where they said that the relationship of the crust of the Earth, and that includes, like, you know, down to the depths of the ocean, you know, however deep an ocean can go, like the relationship of the crust of the Earth to the rest of the Earth is the same as the relationship of the skin of the apple to an apple. And that just sits in my head rent-free. I'm just constantly wowed by that. And how does that figure in to physics?
Yeah, boy. I think that analogy you just described, that the skin of an apple is roughly the thickness of the, let's say, the crust. Is that a good term? You think the crust of the Earth?
Yeah, including the depths of the oceans. And we don't even know how deep the oceans go. That's weird to me.
I think we do know that the deepest part of the ocean, I think I could say discovered until now, but we've probed those depths pretty well. Not that we know everything that's down there, but we know that the deepest part of the ocean is the so-called Mariana Trench in the South Pacific Ocean. But if it's something like, I'm going to get this wrong, it's something like 7 miles deep. But we got to contrast that 7 miles, right, which is maybe what? That's the distance across San Francisco?
Yeah.
That's, you know, it doesn't seem like it's that far. That compared to the radius of the Earth, that is the distance from the surface, from San Francisco to the center, that's something like 4,000 miles. So 7 miles
is
compared
nothing
to 4,000. So it really does seem like it's about the apple skin thickness compared to a normal apple. Yeah.
Right.
And then it gets worse with the atmosphere. You know, that there's the skin of the apple, then that's the land, right? Then we have this thin layer of gas on top of that, the atmosphere, and that is about another crust layer thickness. So if we go upward instead of downward, not say 7 miles to the Mariana Trench's bottom, but if we go upward just 20 miles, we've got 99% of the atmosphere beneath us. So we're essentially out in space.
Wow.
So it's across San Francisco's distance downward to get us through the crust.
So,
and then, at least a portion. And then just going to San Jose upward, it gets us out of the atmosphere.
Wow. So it's almost like the condensation on an apple that you took out of the fridge. That's the atmosphere.
Yeah, I think so.
Wow. See, that blows my mind. It blows my mind that we're able to live on this.
Yeah, and how protective it is. Man, if that atmosphere, as thin as it is, if that atmosphere weren't there, we would be, well, toast is not quite the right analogy, but we would be dead very quickly. Yeah.
So is that what happened to the dinosaurs? That I heard that like a comet or meteor came in kind of sideways and skittered off and threw up all of this stuff into the atmosphere. And did it actually maybe puncture the atmosphere?
Ooh, cool. Yeah, it did poke a hole. I'm sure that hole got filled up very quickly by a gas. You know, the way a gas fill up, if you let it puncture a balloon, the gas will move out of the balloon very quickly. So that hole in the atmosphere created by that impacting asteroid, this is something like 65 million years ago. This asteroid hit in very near the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, so kind of the Caribbean Sea, or what some people still call the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay.
And it hit, and it's just amazing that it did as much damage as it did. This was a sized asteroid that we hope nothing similar hits in our lives.
How big was it? What did you say?
Okay, I think it was something like the size of a small mountain.
Okay.
Yeah, so something like maybe Mount Tam. And I hope I'm right about that, but not a huge thing compared to the Earth. Good grief, it really is dinky. But it's fairly massive, a small mountain, and it's moving very fast relative to the Earth. So it plows into the Yucatan Peninsula, and it throws up so much debris, and that debris itself is going so fast that the debris goes to all other parts of the Earth, and it rains down as sub-meteorites, that is, as small asteroids, but now hitting everywhere on the Earth, and in the process, because these bits also have so much energy, starting fires just about everywhere.
Wow.
And these fires threw up so much smoke into the atmosphere that even though the atmosphere was as thick, or rather as thin, as ever, it was punishingly obscuring of the sun. And we went through what Carl Sagan, one of my heroes, referred to as a kind of, well, in our case, it would be a nuclear winter.
Mm.
Nuclear in his case, because he was trying to discourage the simultaneous release of a lot of nuclear bombs on Earth. But in this case, it was not nuclear. It was just good old physics and chemistry, plowing these multiple fragments of the original impact asteroid in the Yucatan, spinning around the world, plummeting to Earth again, very hot, hitting the Earth, making more heat in their impact, setting fires to forests all around the world, darkening the Earth through the soot and smoke, and therefore killing the planet after an initial baking, because the hypothesis is that in those initial impacts all around the world, the temperature of the atmosphere locally now, that is in the first, the first mile of the atmosphere, rose to something like 700 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, my God.
So this is pizza oven temperature.
Wow.
So you can bet that most of the creatures on Earth perished.
And then they came back.
Well, the little guys, the ones that were underground, the ones in the water, they're the ones that survived much better.
But wouldn't the water have boiled?
This is what we're told. Makes sense that it gave rise to the mammals, the world of mammals, previously dominated by the dinosaurs.
But wouldn't the oceans have boiled?
Yeah, the water has this remarkable property of not changing temperature easily. So I said that, the lower layers of the atmosphere went up dramatically in temperature, right? I said 700 degrees Fahrenheit. But water, it's much harder to change the temperature of water. We say water has a lot of thermal inertia. And so the temperatures of the oceans did rise, but not enough to kill marine life. It certainly did some damage, but not the way it did on land.
Okay. So I heard that... and I've seen a number of YouTubes on this, that the year 536 AD is considered the worst year in history because of there was like a devastating volcanic eruption that obscured so much of the sun that it created famine across the world. Do you know anything about that?
I don't. Please tell me the year now. Because 536. I want to look this up. What's the year you think
it was? 536 AD. There was like a massive eruption. It blotted out the sun in most of Europe. There was massive famine. Like basically, they thought the Earth was coming to an end, and it lasted it was blotted out for a long, long time.
Wow!
And it sounds like,
I can't imagine how scary that must have been.
But it sounds like a sort of a mini version of what happened, except going in the opposite direction. Like the meteor hitting created huge temperature rises, whereas the volcanic thing dropped the temperature.
Right, right. And I think probably the meteor impact did eventually reduce the temperature. But yeah, just as you're saying, from this volcano, and this still can happen today, when a volcano erupts, if it produces enough light obscuring gas, mm-hmm. that obscured sunlight ends up cooling the Earth. Yeah, so it's a strike against global warming, but not the kind we necessarily want.
Right. Okay. But we've gotten far afield from physics. Let's go back to physics. How about this? Why don't you explain to me and our listening audience what physics is, like what is it actually? And I want you to delve more into conceptual physics so that I can wrap my head around it. Not on the quantum scale, because that's just weird, but in the real world.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I love the question. Thank you, Marilyn.
You're welcome.
I think in the old days, and I mean way old, physics was referred to as natural philosophy, the philosophy of nature.
Okay.
But I don't mean nature as the part that we love, the trees and the bugs and the birds, but rather nature writ large, nature with a capital N, as in physical reality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the philosophy of physical reality. How's that for a mouthful? And it's not the way it begins if you take a high school physics course, but it probably gets there to feeling like that, like natural philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Not moral philosophy, right? We're not trying to tell people how to behave or how they should behave, but it is getting to the understanding of the way of, how about this? This is the way one rather famous physicist has described it. Physics is the attempt to understand the rules of reality.
Okay.
So we see patterns, we see regularities in nature of trees, but trees are tough, right? Biology is a harder subject than
mm-hmm.
physics. Physics is getting at the underlying action that's going on inside trees, inside rocks, inside stars. So I've got to say, and I think all scientists would agree that physics is not the best science. Who knows what that is? But physics is the most fundamental science,
okay.
is that it gets at the basic laws that describe all of the goings-on we see around us. It's not so good at helping us with understanding humans,
right? Okay.
Because humans have this amazing structure in their skulls that makes their lives rich and complicated and tough. But we think that even the laws of physics apply inside our brains. And so there are neuroscientists who are also, neuro meaning brain,
mm-hmm.
neuroscientists who are biophysicists who apply physics to biology to great success so far, even though, as I just said, biology and especially psychology are such difficult sciences.
Okay, that opens up a whole can of worms for me, because I always thought, when I think of physics, up until you just explained it, I thought physics was just figuring out movement. But you're saying that physics is more than just movement.
Well, I'd say it starts there, right? In those basic classes, the first subject of physics is the study of motion. And that's why the first question I enjoyed with your audience today was, how fast are you moving, right? The how fast, that's a motion question.
Mm-hmm.
So that does seem to be the place to start, because without motion, the universe is static and is incredibly boring,
okay.
right? It seems like motion is one of those fundamental ideas that we ought to try to understand before moving on to see what it is that's doing the moving.
Okay, so if you've got the fundamentals now of studying motion, that's like, you know, I'll say physics 1A or introduction, like the first day.
Yeah.
So then after motion, what comes next?
All right. Well, in part of that motion is trying to study the forces of nature. And now you think, well, good grief, there are all kinds of forces. Everybody pushes and pulls, and cars hit their brakes, and you run into a wall. But we're going again deeper. Physicists have managed to figure out, after thousands of years of testing, that there are four basic, so-called basic forces in nature. Mm-hmm. And one of them we're all aware of that's pretty obvious, and that is gravity. And I'll mention the others if you like, but even we got to admit that gravity itself is still quite a mystery. You know, when I take an apple, right, in the Sir Isaac Newton sense, and I just drop an apple, I get it, it falls down. But when we really ask ourselves, why did the apple fall? Mm-hmm. It's not adequate to say, oh, that's gravity. You know, words, single words, don't really constitute a helpful explanation. And it's actually more fun, I think, to say, look at how weird that is, that the Earth can somehow pull on the apple without touching it. Right? There seems to be so-called action at a distance here. The Earth is down there, and the apple is up here in my hand, mm-hmm. and I release the apple, and somehow the Earth pulls it down. How does that happen? And here's where Newton's great insight comes into play. Newton was the first person to realize that the same force that pulls the apple out of my hand mm-hmm. is the force that makes the moon go around the Earth once every 30 or so days. Because, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, yeah, Newton had the apple fall out of the tree on his head, and so he discovered gravity. But that really wasn't the big insight. Everybody knew that things fall. Mm-hmm. What Newton did was figure out that the same force that applies on Earth and makes apples fall, described by a certain law of physics, mm-hmm. applies in the heavens. And what most people on Earth thought was, if not heaven itself, it was certainly heavenly up there. Mm-hmm. And that somehow that humans could figure out a law of physics that applies in the heavens, man, that was a big moment for humanity. And we give that credit to Sir Isaac Newton.
Well, let me ask you this. Well, like, speaking of Sir Isaac Newton, so Isaac Newton comes up with this thing that says, hey, the moon is affected by gravity. But as we all know, like Galileo and Copernicus got some serious pushback when they started tampering with our understanding of how things outside of the Earth work. What kind of response did Isaac Newton get?
Yeah, he got some pushback. Sorry. Oh, I see. Pardon me just a minute. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. he got pushback, but his arguments were so persuasive that the majority of educated people in the world accepted it. They didn't, not on faith, but again, the evidence that he gave, the fact that he could use his equations to predict just how long the moon would take to orbit the Earth and other objects would orbit the sun. That was a huge achievement. And so while to this day we still have people who think that the Earth is flat, I'm sure there are people that think that gravity is the Earth doesn't gravitate, it sucks, or something like that. But nowadays, and I got to say, within, maybe a decade of Newton, mm-hmm. the pushback had subsided. His arguments and the evidence he presented were just so persuasive that the same physics textbook that we use in Cambridge, England, we also use in San Francisco and in Sichuan, China. And, you know, that's one thing, the language we express the book in, language of the writing of the book writing is different, but mm-hmm. the ideas are the same.
Interesting. I've got a lot, like every time you say something, it makes me forget the other questions in lieu of a new question, but I'm going to try. I have two questions. One of them I can remember. Okay. So there's the thing where you have a pound of feathers and a pound of rocks or something, and they say you okay. drop them, theoretically they're going to fall at the same speed because they weigh the same. But is that true? Because say, like, you have a pound of feathers, but maybe they're not all squished together, they're kind of spread out and they have resistance, versus like a tiny piece of lead. So is that accurate to say that two things that weigh the same will fall at the same speed?
Wow. Oh man, Marilyn, this is This is such a good question, and it ain't easy. So you're going to have to cut me off if I ramble on too long. But
okay.
All right, but let's take a small pebble and an equally heavy, big feather.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's really a dinky. Maybe it's just a grain of sand. Who knows? And we got a feather that is, of course, quite light, but they're both the same weight.
Mm-hmm.
So we put them on a bathroom scale, or no, let's say a kitchen scale mm-hmm. that can measure light weights. And they both say, some small amount of weight. All right. And yet we drop them, and the grain of sand falls immediately to the ground,
mm-hmm.
whereas the feather kind of wafts its way down, takes that lazy trip to
mm-hmm.
the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, all right, now, come on. They're the same weight. Why don't they fall the same? Well, the catch is that there are two, that there's a different second force applying to each of those objects.
Mm, what is it?
Okay, both the grain of sand and the feather have gravity pulling them downward.
Okay.
And to the same amount. You know, let's call that 1 ounce of downward gravitational force.
Okay.
But there's a second force if we're dropping these because we're dropping them in the air. And that's the so-called force of air resistance.
Okay.
And for a little grain of sand with its tiny area plummeting through the air, that's a very small force. Air resistance is really dinky on a grain of sand.
Mm-hmm.
But on a big feather that plows through quite a bit of air as it falls downward, air resistance is much bigger.
Okay.
So in the end, it's the cumulative effect, the net force on an object that determines its acceleration, in this case, downward. And the grain of sand has the force of gravity plus a tiny bit of air resistance.
Okay.
Whereas the feather has the force of gravity, same amount, 1 ounce, minus the upward force of air resistance, which might be 0.9 ounces. So the downward force on that feather, the net, the total downward force in that feather, is less than on the grain of sand, even though they both have the same weight. So let me describe an experiment. Now, you shouldn't be saying that, Tucker. That doesn't sound right. One of the first experiments that the astronauts did on the surface of the moon,
mm-hmm.
this is in 1969, the Apollo astronauts took an eagle feather and a hammer, right, a good old a metal hammer,
mm-hmm.
and dropped them on the surface of the moon from a height of ordinary standing height, maybe 5 feet off the ground. This ground was lunar soil.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so beautiful because they showed this on camera, with live camera footage from the moon. We saw the astronaut release the hammer and the eagle feather at the same time on the moon, where there is negligible atmosphere, and they both fell at the same rate. They both fell, as we say, like a stone.
Wow.
Yeah, the feather just went clunk on the lunar soil. So it turned out, this is another confirmation of Newton, that the air resistance really makes the difference for a feather. And it's air resistance that allows airplanes themselves to stay in the air.
Now, if you drop things from a high point, is there a point where they no longer accelerate, or do they continue to accelerate as they get closer and closer to the Earth?
Oh, yeah, that's cool. Maybe you and your listeners have heard of the term of terminal velocity. Yeah, and then terminal does not mean you die here. Terminal just means as in final and not changing.
Okay.
So I think the story is that if you're a skydiver,
mm-hmm.
you put on your parachute, you jump out of an airplane, and you immediately start to accelerate.
Mm-hmm.
The term is at 1G,
mm-hmm.
and you're going faster and faster relative to the Earth, heading towards the Earth. But while that gravitational force is constant on you, that's your weight. Let's say you're a 200-pounder, you got 200 pounds of force pulling you down. But the upward force on you, due to air resistance, steadily increases.
Okay.
Until what? Until finally, the air resistance equals 200 pounds but it's upward. So you, the downward force of you due to gravity is 200 pounds,
uh-huh.
and now the upward force on you has built up due to air resistance to 200 pounds. That's upward force. And if you add those two forces, 200 pounds downward minus 200 pounds upward, that leads to zero. Now, what does that mean? You stop? No. Zero is the total force. And forces don't cause speeds. They don't cause velocities. Forces cause accelerations. So you, with zero force on you, you stop accelerating. You've reached this high speed, plowing through the air, but now you don't go any faster. And
oh.
I've heard that number is 120 miles per hour for a human.
So that's the same as like when you're on a plane, it takes off and you feel it and then it reaches, it sort of finds its level and you find your level.
Hmm.
Or not.
Okay, I'm trying to get what you mean. Can you explain that? I want to
understand. So you're saying, so if you fall, there's a pressure down and there's a pressure up, and when it equals zero, you're not accelerating anymore, so you just kind of experience the same way you experience it once you hit that steady speed on a plane.
Yeah. There, of course, you don't feel air resistance because you're inside this aluminum tube, but when you sit, but the aluminum tube itself is feeling the force of gravity downward, right?
Mm-hmm.
Planes are heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And they also feel this, it's for airplanes, it's called lift, but it is a kind of upward air resistance. Yeah, and so when we're seated in the airplane, we feel, let's say I weigh 200 pounds, gravity is pulling me down into the airplane seat with 200 pounds of force,
mm-hmm.
and that's still good old gravity, but it's the seat cushion that pushes up on my booty with a force of 200 pounds.
Okay.
And, you know, that seat cushion's attached to the seat, and the seat's attached to the plane, and the plane is this aluminum tube, which itself is being held up by the force of lift, of air resistance. So you can see how complicated this gets, and it's part of the reason people think of physics as being complicated, but it's nothing like a human brain or a human body. You know, those are complicated.
Well, I also heard that, because it sounds like that's the reason why cats that fall from a super high distance don't get as injured as cats who fall from a medium distance. Like they kind of, like they stop accelerating, and so when they hit the ground, they're better off than if they're hitting the ground while they're still accelerating.
Yeah, and when you, maybe they, if they fall from a higher distance, they have a little more time to reorient their bodies, right? We were told that cats always land on their feet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so even if you drop a cat upside down, on the way down, it can do a little aerial gymnastics and turn itself over. That's a neat trick based on the, largely due to the cat's tail, right? It rotates its tail clockwise,
mm-hmm.
and that allows the body to counter-rotate counterclockwise, and so orient its feet in the right direction. And I guess the story is, yeah, if you're mean enough to drop a cat upside down from, say, just 1 foot, it won't be pleasant. It'll get hurt. Maybe not die, but it'll get hurt, but or even get injured. But if you drop a cat from 4 feet upside down, I think then has time, even though it'll hit the ground going faster, the cat will have time to turn over and land on its feet.
Okay. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. We're speaking with Tucker Hyatt from WonderFest about science and about all the things and, you know, all the things I don't know. So I'm going to ask you this because I've thought about this with water and air. Okay, so fish in the air, basically, they just fly. Like, if you're in water, you're basically flying. But if you're on land, you are earthbound. So how is it, number one, that air and water are, like, so, like, how is it not a general, like, a gradient? How do we go, it's like water, boom, air. And then why don't we fly? Because I want to fly, not in a plane.
Remember you asked me about the first subject that one would study in physics, and we agreed that motion made sense as the first subject.
Yeah.
Well, the next section in our physics class will be, we have to search for a one-word title. Let's call it matter.
Okay.
Yeah? What it is that's doing the moving. And you're right. There's this idea of the so-called phases or states of matter.
Mm-hmm.
We know about solids and liquids and gases.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great question. Why? Why isn't there a continuum of states of matter? Why these three? And it's a literally sticky business. It has to do with the peculiarities of the molecules of solid, liquid, and gas you're talking about. So let's take a familiar one, water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that, you know, we've got solid water is ice, liquid water of the sea and swimming pool,
mm-hmm.
and then we have the gaseous water, which is usually referred to as steam.
Mm-hmm.
Although even there's an intermediate state called water vapor. And man, when I say it's a sticky subject, because these water molecules have this amazing property of stickiness that gives water its special properties, gives it a very high boiling temperature, allows it to store. So I mentioned thermal inertia, right, that water has and keeps it from changing temperature easily. You know, the watched pot never boils,
mm-hmm.
that old saying. You know, it just takes time. I appreciate that you're grilling me so well with your questions. Would you maybe allow me a minute or two to talk about an upcoming Wonderfest event?
I was going to ask you to talk about Wonderfest events. I just keep getting sidetracked by your explanations of things.
Well, okay, I love the sidetrack. So when you're ready for a quick description of an upcoming and very free Wonderfest event, not very far from San Francisco, then I'll tell you.
Okay, but before you do, we're having a little bit of difficulty with the audio. I don't know what it is. I think it's one of those things where you have to find a specific position and then just freeze in it, and it should be fine.
Sorry, I was waving my phone around foolishly.
Oh, okay. So now you're quite clear. All right, so take it away.
Okay. Well, here I am, the founding director of this, I claim it's the world's smallest nonprofit called Wonderfest. Its proper subtitle is the Bay Area Beacon of Science.
Mm-hmm.
And one of its functions is to bring scientists to the general public. Indeed, a week from tomorrow, that's Tuesday, August 12th,
mm-hmm.
up in Marin, but not a long drive, maybe a longish public transit ride, but there is public transit available from San Francisco to Marin.
Mm-hmm.
A scientist from UC Berkeley, Go Bears,
mm-hmm.
yes,
yep.
Maryland, yeah.
We are sons of California.
Dr. Ellie Tubman is giving a talk on, I think, a beautifully promising technology called nuclear fusion. The title of her talk is The Future of Fusion Energy on Tap.
Mm.
And it's that on tap part that's alluring. Because we've probably all heard of nuclear power as
mm-hmm.
a way of generating electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, that is a primary way that humans over much of the Earth do generate electricity. But a much more promising way to produce electricity that is a nuclear process also, is through nuclear fusion. It's the fusion fuel is abundant, and the fusion process is remarkably safe and non-polluting. So the fact that Dr. Tubman, Ellie Tubman from UC Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
is going to talk about this gives me hope that it might happen someday soon. Here's the story people tell about the promise of nuclear fusion for generating electricity. They say, old-timers say, well, I've heard that it's 20 years away, and I've heard that throughout every year of my life for decades.
Okay.
It'll always be 20 years away.
Okay.
But I don't know. I think Dr. Tubman will show us in a talk that is free and accessible to everybody, and that doesn't require a physics degree, that maybe she'll make it clear that this is coming.
And I'm just going to let our listeners know that's Tuesday, August 12th at 7 p.m. at the Hop Monk Tavern, which is a 224 Vintage Way in Novato.
Yes, if they've got internet access, if they go to Wonderfest, all one word, wonderfest.org, they'll see their upcoming events, and that's the most, that's the soonest upcoming event.
Okay. Now, I'm going to skip over the insect one because it creeps me out. I want to talk, you've got one coming called Sleep and Recovery in September.
Yeah, yeah. The speaker there is a physician, an MD, PhD, I think he's got both degrees, from California Pacific Medical Center and from UC San Francisco, who will tell us about how a good night's sleep can be gotten and is so important for our health.
Okay, and that is September 16th at the same place, Hot Monk Tavern, 224 Vintage Way in Novato.
But I want to, because I'm not a big bug fan myself, but just check out, I take it you're looking online.
Yeah.
There's an old friend of mine from Cal, from UC Berkeley, Dr. Bernard Lewis, and the man knows bugs. And so Bernard is going to tell us about every kind of creepy crawler. But he may do something that I hope is startling and disgusting to everybody, and that is he likes to begin his talks by taking a small cardboard box full of what looks like dirt, and he dumps it on the table in front of him, in front of the audience, and he says, "This is 2 pounds of bug bodies."
Ew.
And he said, "This is how much each of us eats every year."
Ew.
Just in the process of cooking and eating our own food and going out to restaurants. 2 pounds of bugs. Oh man.
See, this is why I can't talk to you.
But he also helps us to get away from bugs because his specialty is termites and bed bugs and what else. Anyway, he's good for offering advice on how to keep ants out of your house. So, but he also helps us appreciate how remarkable these bugs are, because if that next asteroid does hit the Earth, the bugs are going to make it.
Yeah.
We won't. So they got something going for them.
That's true. I once hit a cockroach with a shovel, and I had to hit it like 6 times before it would finally die. So, yeah, they're going to live. They're going to live. Those Georgia cockroaches are tough, so.
Oh, man. At least it didn't try to pick up the shovel and get even with
you. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the next one, because they all have a collective consciousness. But we're not going to talk about that. Does Wonderfest ever do events in San Francisco?
Yes, yes. In fact, we're doing one with the Commonwealth Club. Let me see if I can tell you about that. Give me just a minute.
Okay.
It takes place on the 9th of October.
Mm-hmm.
It happens at the Commonwealth Club. This one won't be free, but it's always reasonable. And it's a conversation with Mary Roach, who is a rather famous writer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen her
I'm
books.
My phone. I'm sorry. Oh, I can't tell you. I wish I could tell you what the subject of her. It has something to do with a deep dive into replaceability. What substances that we use in our everyday life, what is replaceable and what isn't? And Mary Roach is such a cool writer and an equally good speaker that I think that'll be a fun event for San Franciscans.
Do you remember any of the books that she's written? That's right, Bonk and Stiff and Packing for Mars.
Oh, yes, Packing for Mars. Yeah, a lot of one-word titled books, each of them fun.
Okay. And so if we went to the website for Wonderfest, would we be able to find a link to that talk in October, or is that not going to happen until October?
It'll be up within, how about 10 days, that'll be announced. That's far and away. If people just remember the name Wonderfest and the fact that a drive from the city to the doctor is saying it's a half hour away.
Sounds like you're waving your phone around again.
It sounds like it's terrible traffic time. I think it's really not that bad a drive. Yeah, I was wrong about that.
Oh. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Tucker Hyatt, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, I've loved it, Marilyn. I appreciate you and your audience so much.
All right. Well, people of Earth, you've heard it here. I am, largely ignorant of science. I have like sort of random knowledge. It's always nice to talk to people who are scientists, who know how to explain things, who are willing to make it accessible for people like me so that we don't end up believing that the Earth is flat and, that specious things. I'm going to leave you with Les McCann. It's snarky and it's for our guests. It's called Compared to What? So until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo. KPOO, San Francisco.